Have a good time.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Howdy, my name's Scott Lee. I'm an alcoholic, and very, very grateful to be here, and what a gift. What a gift. And a little bit overwhelmed. I imagine that he's right. They'll have a good conference next year, but you guys have been fantastic. These speakers have just been absolutely astonishing, every one of you. I know all of you. I've heard all of you many times before. I've never heard any of you do a better talk than you did here. It was really spectacular. And thanks. So here I am trying to follow that. I wish you could hear the talk I made about 3 o'clock this morning. It was a good one. I'd like to thank the people who worked to make this happen. I'd like to thank Ben for taking the credit. Because someone has to do it, and I'd like to thank Lee, and I'd like to tell you I bought something from him, and I hope you did too, because it's important to me that he continue. I don't know that I would have made it if an old timer hadn't been giving me cassettes like this when I got here. So I thank you and I salute you, Lee, and thank you very much. And thank Jeremiah for being such a great host. You've been wonderful. Thank you. And I'd like to start with a quotation from Lois Wilson, who was asked one time what she did in the moment of silence. She said, "I invite God to the meeting." It's not, I don't believe he's here. I do believe that. But I get a special gift when I stop and honor that presence. And so in a couple of moments, I'm going to ask you to do that. Maybe there's somebody here that you don't have a God. You got here like I did, afraid there might be one, and you're trying to figure out how to hide from him based on what you've been told. If that's your situation, borrow mine. I recommend him very highly. He has a great sense of humor. You must have noticed that this weekend. Address him as a God of Scott's limited understanding. Get you off on the right foot. So let's just take a moment and acknowledge the presence of deity. I'll just meet you back here. Amen. Thank you. So I hope I'm going to talk some about my experiences with steps 10 and 11. I don't trust me. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory. When we were wrong, probably admitted it. or something like that. That's my history. I would admit it if I thought you had done something worse or I was pretty sure I'd already been forgiven, but I don't have a long history of that admitted thing. As I read, starting on page 84 in the text, I find the word continue 4 times in the first paragraph on the reading of step 10. So to me, step 10 is about staying present in my own life moment by moment. And I think for me, there's a slogan. It's the second most difficult of the slogans. The hardest one, of course, is one day at a time. Hardest assignment I've ever been given, simply to be here. But the second hardest is easy does it. I'm mocked to with my hair on fire most of the time. And so it's important for me to slow down and notice. And I'm going to do some things I'd rather not do up here. I've prayed about it. I think it's what I'm supposed to do. I'm going to tell you some stories about some mistakes I've made. And it wasn't that long ago. There are a couple of people in this room who remember when I did this one. I was in a meeting, and a guy who I think was in a halfway house got to talking about some religious terms. That's real hard for me to listen to. The first man I sponsored that made it had the experience of being molested by a deacon of the church in the church house from the time he was 6 till he was 12. And I've also worked with 3 different men who were, as altar boys, raped by priests. So, and page 93 in the book is very clear about that we have to leave those things outside. And I did the wrong thing. I did the right thing, but I did it the wrong way. I interrupted him, and I hijacked the meeting and started an argument, and he and I finally both quit, and by the time the meeting was over, I realized I'd made a bad mistake, and I went to him and tried to make an amend. He wouldn't or couldn't hear me, and haven't seen him since. I called my sponsor and told him what I'd done, and he said, "Welcome to the human race." I've got a sponsee who's done that twice so far this year, and so don't worry about it. And I said, "I think I need to go make amends to the individual if I can find him," which I have not been able to, and also to the group. So the next time that group met, I told them what I had done, and that I was wrong, and that what I should have done was wait till after the meeting and go to him and say, "Probably my religious beliefs are pretty similar to yours." But page 93 in the book says, when dealing with such a person, you'd better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There's no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he might already be confused. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are. It's real important for me to leave those things outside, because I can't allow my own particular beliefs to take away someone else's chance at recovery. And that's possible if we cross that line. And so I should have gone to him. I've had the privilege for the last 15 years of sponsoring a fellow who lives in Kiev, Ukraine. And he's gotten out, by the way. Though many of you know Oleg. He and his family are in Budapest right now. They got out. But he does a once-a-week meeting with the people that he sponsors on Zoom, and he invited me to it a couple of weeks ago. And one of them said, "We're having a problem. As we do our Zoom meetings, that people are wanting to talk about this conflict that's going on here, and it's taken us away from AA." And he said, "What should I do?" And because I had the gift of having made that mistake, I had an answer for him. It may not be the best one, but it was a good one. And I said, "What you should do is go to the people who are bringing that up and tell them you understand their feelings completely. But we have to keep AA, AA. That we have to leave all outside things outside. As serious as this is, we must leave it outside. Our business here is to save the lives of alcoholics. And if we get wrapped up in anything else, we can't do it." So I received the gift of having made a mistake that gave me the gift of having an answer that I don't think I would have had. And I think that's part of what recovery is about for me. Continuing on page 84, it says, when these crop up, it's not an if question. I heard Sandy say one time that the measure of my recovery is not if I get off the path. We all get off the path. The measure of my recovery is how quickly I get back on. And I think that's right. And I think step 10 is about knocking me back onto the path, owning my mistakes and getting back quickly. And it says love and tolerance of others is our code. My own definition of tolerance is it's a premeditated loving response to someone I don't think deserves it. That's really what that is. And there was a guy many years ago, there was a guy in my home group, and I'm going to refer to him as Edward, which is the right thing. It's what he said his name was. But anyway, every time Edward opened his mouth, my fur got rubbed the wrong way. I didn't like the way he drank his coffee. I just, oh. And I'm sitting there one time as he chairs this meeting, being very unhappy with Edward. And I hear my sponsor's voice in the back of my head saying, "If you spot it, you got it." What Edward was doing is he was moderating the meeting. After everyone talked, he would talk. And I thought, "Oh, my God, I do that." And so I stopped. And the next time Edward did something that upset me, I searched myself, and I had that too. And Edward became one of my greatest teachers. He had all of my character defects. He had them much worse than I had them. I must be honest with you. But I followed him around like a puppy. And I learned so much from Edward. So I wonder if I'm having to tolerate someone, if I don't need to take a look, see if there's a lesson there for me somewhere. So everybody out here, I'm trapped in here. I'm stuck in this skin. I used to get out all the time. Three shots of Cuervo Gold, I'm out, right? Jack Daniels knows how to get me out of here. I'm stuck in here, and the first thing I had to do was clean it up. And that's what these first 9 steps are about that you people presented so beautifully, is for me to clean it up so I can stand to be in here. And I was going to do about 10 minutes on this next paragraph about we've stopped fighting anything or anything, but Steve did a fine job on that on steps 4 and 5. So I'm going to skip that. But generally what it says is, I'm not going to be interested in liquor anymore. And it's come automatically without any focus on liquor. We've had a tremendous amount of focus and a tremendous amount of work by this point, but it hasn't been focused on my attitude toward booze. That I'm focused on the solution, not on the problem. And it says it's easy to let up in the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. If it's easy to let up, it must require effort to not let up, it seems to me. And I'm told that this laurels is a reference to, I don't know if it's ancient Greece or ancient Rome, it's one or the other, where the athlete would win the discus or the 100-meter dash or whatever, and they would take, laurel was a vine, and they would weave it into a wreath, and he'd wear it on his head, much like an athlete wearing a medal. So he would wear the laurel on his head as a emblem of his victory. So if I'm resting on my laurels, guess where my head is? Somebody, that was a good guess. Yeah. And it says we're headed for trouble. We do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured. And I misunderstood this sentence many, many years. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual program, spiritual condition. I thought it was contingent on my spiritual condition, which I don't know what it is. Sometimes when people ask me, how are you? I say, I don't know. I haven't asked my sponsor yet today. Because I don't know. I don't know. It's like my spiritual growth. It's not something I do. It's something I receive, and I'm not qualified to measure it or judge it. I'm just not qualified. But on the maintenance, I can do that. I think maintenance for me means two things. To maintain in the sense of not losing something I've already got, and also maintenance in the same sense that I maintenance my car. I rotate the tires. I got the right pressure in them. I change the oil on time. I vacuum it out. I wash it. I maintenance my spiritual condition through daily prayer and meditation, reading spiritual literature, taking meetings into gated communities. That's a jail, you know. And letting people in traffic, saying please and thank you, doing the things that you've taught me. I'm a good judge if I'm doing the maintenance of my spiritual condition, but I'm not a judge at all of what my spiritual condition is. And then we have the second of the... and then it says, every day is today we must carry the vision of God's will in all of our activities. Every day. I don't get any days off. The vision, the best I can see, God's will, what would have me do next, and all of my activities. There it is. When I get a new sponsee and get him through step 9, I like to do a 2-week focus on step 10. Just to say the 10, 11, and 12 thing, like a little group and just sort of send them off, doesn't work for me. I like to give him a 2-week focus on it. I want him to read those two pages a couple of 3 times a week. If you're in a meeting, they call for a topic from the floor, bring up step 10, see what you get. And don't do it more than once at the same meeting. And find 4 or 5 people that you have great respect for and ask them to talk to you about step 10. And after 2 weeks of that, you and I will go through these 2 pages together. And I'll do the same thing on 11 and the same thing on 12 to just put some focus on them. It seems to be working for us. It says, how can I best serve thee, thy will not mine be done? And then further down it says, to some extent we become God conscious to develop this vital sixth sense. Vital, I'm told, is from the Latin word vita, which means life. So vital is either life-giving or necessary to life. And I had 10 years when a sponsee was 6 months said, well, I guess if I'm still using my other 5 senses trying to get my own will, I might not develop this vital sixth sense. And I said, would you sponsor me? So to me, step 10 is about staying present in my own life and owning my mistakes. And it's been within the last year or two. I was sitting beside a stream with no fishing tackle in my hand, which is very unusual. And I was looking across, and I saw a cloud. And it occurred to me, every drop of rain in that cloud is following God's will perfectly. I know it is. And across the stream, there's a tree. There's a bird sitting up there. I thought, well, so is the bird. And I looked down into the stream, and there are minnows swimming around. And I thought, well, so are those minnows. Why can't I? And I got my answer. It may not be your answer. It's mine. And my answer is I am. I'm convinced that the depths of my soul is not my job to be perfect. It's not. You know, we use the word progress. I give you my definition. Progress is making the same old mistake a little less often, or making a new and finer quality mistake. Because anything beyond that's perfection, that's not my assignment. So if my assignment's not to be perfect, what's my assignment? My assignment is to make mistakes. And they've sent the right guy. And that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. My job is to make, it's not okay to make mistakes, it's my assignment. And I've been told all my life, we learn from our mistakes. Well, if that's true, then no one in this room's got more than one DUI. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So guys like me do not learn from our mistakes. Guys like me learn from living with the results of our mistakes. If you hold that thought and read the 12 steps, I think you'll notice about half of them are about me embracing the results of my mistakes. That's where the learning occurs. So, excuse me. So this is the learning process as I understand it today. One, make a mistake. Two, be notified I made a mistake. I don't always know. Three, own the mistake. Yeah, that was me. And if they only know 80%, I have to tell them the other 20. That's how I own the mistake. Item four, consult a spiritual advisor about how to. Item five, make the amend. Usually, not always. Usually there's an amend. Item six is embrace the lesson. A mistake is just an invitation to a lesson. That's all it is. And the evidence is if I'd already learned the lesson, I would not have made the mistake. And I don't have the power to make a mistake so ugly that God can't turn it into something wonderful. Not fix. That's who I am, it's who He is. It is that simple. So item six is embrace the lesson. Item seven is share the lesson, because that's what really sets it for me. And item eight is when I share the lesson, I have to tell you I made the mistake. If I just share the lesson, I'm preaching, and not many of us want to hear that. When I tell you that I made the mistake, I stand as a sinner beside a sinner. You can hear me. And I can hear you. I could hear you guys this weekend when you talk about your mistakes and the lessons that came with them. I can hear you that way. And item nine, make the next mistake. It's why I'm here. There is such a phenomenal freedom that's come for me in that. And the freedom has two halves. The first half is I have my own permission to make mistakes. I expect me to make mistakes. I am convinced it's why I'm here. Is to make the mistakes and embrace the lessons. And I know me now, from what you've taught me, that I'll own them like I did the one I just talked to you about. I'll own it, I'll make the amends, I'll do everything I'm supposed to do with it, which is the most I can do. That's half of the freedom. I have my own permission to make mistakes. The other half, the Al-Anon half, is you have my permission to make mistakes. If I've got a rope on you holding you in line and you jump out, you pull me with you. The other half of the freedom is when I can release my grip on you. And that's everybody. That's former wives, people who got their driver's licenses out of Cracker Jack boxes, international politicians, everybody. Because if something that someone does can upset me, I'm a prisoner of their behavior. And I don't want to be a prisoner anymore. I was a prisoner of alcohol for an awful long time. And I don't want to be one anymore. And so the freedom is the two halves. I have my own permission to make mistakes, and you have my permission to make mistakes. And that has freed me over the course of the last year and a half or 2 years at a level of freedom I've never had before. It is just astonishing to try to live that. My sponsor told me 37 years ago, he said, prayer is not a sales presentation. It is not an opportunity for you to change God's mind. I always want to be God's coach. Hey, big fella, take a knee. I got some instructions for you, and that never worked out for me. And I had the privilege a number of years ago of flying jet aircraft for the United States Air Force. And one of the airplanes I flew was a C-141. It's a four-engine jet, great big airplane. And we came out of Christchurch, New Zealand, to American Samoa, about an eight-hour flight plan, took on fuel, heading for Honolulu with an eight-hour flight plan, nothing in between but water. And about halfway across, we get into the new fuel, it was contaminated. It had water in it. And at our altitude, they don't call it water. It's minus 50 degrees. They call it ice. And it clogs fuel lines. The jet engines about so big around do not respond well to fuel starvation. And we come down into warmer air. We haven't had one stuck up there yet, but they'll come down. And we're down in this warmer air. We can run the engines down here, but we don't have gas to make Honolulu at this altitude. It's already closer to Guam than it is to go back. A jet engine is more efficient at higher altitude. The first thing you do in a jet, you get in trouble with fuel, is add power and climb. You'll get that climb fuel back. So we climb back up, and we can't stay. And the worst thing you can do for gas mileage on an airplane is this, and that's what we're doing. Because the numbers say we're going to put a 300,000-pound airplane into the Pacific Ocean about 170 miles an hour today, and we're all going to die. Pretty good percentage of this room, I'd imagine it's well over half, have had the experience of thinking that we're going to die in the next moment or two. We have faced jealous husbands. We've laid down bikes and wrecked cars and trucks. We've looked down gun barrels and drug deals gone bad. A lot of us have thought we're going to die for the next moment or two. Let me tell you something. 4 hours is a long time to think you're going to die today. It's a long time. And I promised a God I don't think I believed in if he would get me out of this one. I would quit smoking. I was first. Quit smoking. Quit drinking. Quit visiting ladies I'm not married to. I'm going back to church. The early service. I might even build some churches. Trust me, you don't leave anything in the bag on this one. 10 fuel tanks on this airplane, all saying zero. The engine's still turning. We decided to shoot a forced landing at Hickam. And if we could make what we call high station for a forced landing, we could at least crash on dry land. So our bodies could be sent home for burial. That is the conversation in that cockpit. We turned final at Honolulu at 9,000 feet. If they'd all quit then, we'd have made dry land. We landed on the end of that runway and taxied in and shut them down. And they dipped our fuel tanks like you dip your crankcase, see how much oil you got. We did not have enough fuel left on that plane to start 4 inches and taxi from here to the parking lot. We didn't have that much left. And I didn't even check into the hotel. I went straight into the officer's club, put my bags down on either side of the bar stool and said, Mai Tai, the tall one, pack of smokes, right? Surely you understand that. Yeah. And this is what I see through the eyes you've given me. In those days, when I prayed, I was trying to make him my God. What you've taught me here is how to make me his man. You see, I had it backwards. The difference is this one, by the way, seems to be working pretty well. That other one really didn't. And so I tried to just stay in that, sought through prayer and meditation. That means if I go to sleep in meditation, that's good, because I sought, then that's the most I can do. Sought. It means to put energy into attempt. That's all it means. And for me, we talk a lot about the next right thing. There's a last right thing for me. It's to go to bed at a reasonable hour and set an alarm so I can awaken tomorrow morning with a full night's rest and plenty of time to start tomorrow on a spiritual basis. If I don't do the last right thing tonight, I can't do the first right thing tomorrow morning. Most of the folks I talk to that say they don't have time for morning meditation, problem isn't in the morning. Problem is the night before that I have made choice. Choice is never singular. When I choose something, I choose everything that goes with it. And I choose to not have any of the things that can't go with it. And that means if I choose to stay up late at night, I also choose to not be able to start my day the way I need to the next day. That's one choice. And I didn't like that when I first heard it. I was told, too, the difference between a good habit and a bad habit. Good habits are easy to break. Good habits are easy to break. So if I'm going to have good habits, I'm going to have to work hard to keep them. It says, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Nowhere in this book does it give me permission to beat myself up. If it is, in fact, my job to make mistakes, they can't be mad at me when I do. That would make no sense. What I have to do is embrace the lessons that are attached to them. And I asked a series of questions. And one of them is, were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? That's a pretty good question. It's a pretty good question. To sit quietly in his presence after each day, to make it a tight compartment and review it, and ask myself this question too. not only have I made mistakes of commission, but I make any mistakes of omission. And steps 8 and 9, I pretty much know the things I think I did that harmed you. The things I don't know are the things I failed to do that I should have done that left you harmed. I got this from Miss Linda, who's my former wife. She calls it good amends. It's where I go back and thank the people that deserved more thanks than I gave them. And was there someone I should have thanked yesterday? Was there someone I had the chance to lift their spirit somehow, and I didn't take it? Is there something like that that I can make me a better guy tomorrow? I think those are good questions. And then it says, on awakening. It was pointed out to me, it does not say, after a shower and shave, two overeasy and bacon, a half a pot of coffee, reading the front page, and a fight with her. It says, on awakening. And the second man that I sponsored that made it, used to tell it this way. He said his disease gets up 20 minutes before he does every morning, does some jumping jacks and some push-ups and perches in the headboard and it waits. And when he opens his eyes, rawr, and it jumps on him. And he wakes up with untreated alcoholism every morning, and I do too. And I, you know, the committee is in here. Say, we've been talking. We're glad you're awake now. We got some things we did. There are only two things I'll ever do prior to doing the morning prayer and meditation. One is a quick trip to the bathroom, and the other is I might hit the go button in a coffee pot. I might not. That's it. I got to get right on that. So as we consider our plans today, before we begin, ask God to direct our thinking, especially to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. That's an interesting thought. Divorced is kind of a powerful word. I'm divorced from someone I much love very much. And didn't I love self-pity? Didn't I love self-pity? And I didn't love dishonesty, but I liked what it brought me. And I was willing to do it. And self-seeking, that's all I knew how to do. That defined me beautifully there in a single sentence. And our friend Joe C. from Palm Coast, Florida, y'all need to get him up here. He says, the purpose of morning prayer and meditation is to put my spirit in a state of excited, how does he say it, of excitement about all the great things God's got in store for me today. And I think that's right. That's the purpose of it. It's for me to get connected and to be reminded that there is a loving God who runs this thing, and I'm trying to be his guy, and that's good enough. You know, left to my own devices, I'll take the rest of my life off with pay. I don't want any more lessons. And yet I think that's why I'm here, is to get them. I want to talk a little bit about my own morning prayer. I may have something maybe you can use. Maybe after this is over, somebody can make some suggestions to me. I'd appreciate it very much. I find it helpful if I begin my prayer by thanking God for some things. And it doesn't matter what they are, just an assortment of things. It seems to open the channel. I think all the blocks in the channel between Scott and God are at Scott's end. I think God's end's pretty well open. And but thanking him for some things, and it's a pretty good-sized list, but it varies, seems to open the channel. And then I invite him in to be God today and ask him if I could please be his man today to the best of my ability. And it's been 6 years ago, one day I suddenly realized how judgmental I am. I was 30 years sober. I've been judgmental all my life, but I just suddenly saw it one time, and it didn't feel very good. And I go through life judging people. In those days, before I had this cancer, I was 60 pounds overweight, and I used to be the stunt double for the Pillsbury Doughboy, and I had to give that job up when I lost the weight, and I would judge you for being overweight. I'm in my 70s. I wear a ponytail. I would judge you for having what I thought was a strange haircut. I'm just judging people all day long, but I've been doing it, but I finally saw it. And it occurred to me, I don't think God wants me to judge anyone. I don't think that's part of my assignment. Knowledge of his will and the power to carry it out. So I added to my morning prayer, please bless me that I don't judge anyone today. I can report tremendous progress. Not perfection, but tremendous progress on that front. And some of you remember Ed from Iowa, big fella. He and I did a weekend just before he died, and he told me this story. He was indigent when he came to us, and he was living in Clancy's garage. And he walked in one day, there's a man standing there he didn't recognize, and he put out his name and said, "Hi, my name's Ed." And the other guy says, "I'm Lance Rensel." Most of you are not old enough to recognize that name. Some of you may be. Lance Rensel had been this absolute star wide receiver for the Dallas Cowboys and was married to Joey Heatherton, who was easily the hottest woman on the North American continent. And he had gone to prison for exposing himself on a schoolyard. And Ed says he didn't use any words, but his face said, "I know who you are. I know what you did. I judge you and I condemn you." And Rensel said to him, "I would have thought that an alcoholic would understand how someone could do something they knew was absolutely wrong and not be able to not do it." And Ed said his heart melted. I had the exact same reaction that Ed did. As he told me that story, when he said, "Lance Rensel, I judged him, I did the exact thing he did." And when he said what Rensel said to him, my heart melted too. I wonder what it's like to be him. Don't let me confuse you. I absolutely abhor what he did. I abhor some of the things I did too, and some of them sober. And I'm in no position to judge, and I don't want to judge. It just makes me sick. It just makes me sick. I'm in no position to throw the first stone. None at all. I've got to get out of the judgment business. It just makes me crazy. I have discovered the source of all anger for me. I know where it all comes from. It comes from being sure I'm right. I have never been angry when I wasn't absolutely sure I was right. And being right comes from having passed judgment. So to be angry, I must judge an event or a person that's not being up to the standards that I think they should be up to, so I can be right, so I can be angry. So judgment is the beginning. It is the genesis of anger. And if I don't ever judge, I don't ever get angry. It's an amazing thing. And I started asking God for that. One of the things I ask when I get in a car is ask Him to bless me that I neither endanger nor enrage any of His other children while I'm behind the wheel. It's a good thing, because I don't want to see your traffic finger and I don't want you to see mine. And it's just not a good way to go. And so I ask God each morning to bless me that I don't judge anyone, that I would be emptied of self and filled with His love, shaken together, pressed down, heaped up, overflowing, that would gush out of me all over everyone I meet today. And I ask Him to make me a great listener. I was having a conversation with somebody a year or two ago, and somebody said, "What would you hope people would say at your funeral about you?" And I said, "I would hope they would say I was a great listener, and I don't think I am." So I added that to my morning prayer, that I would be a great listener today, to not sit there so while you make noise waiting for my turn to say these brilliant things that you really need to hear, but to open with my heart and listen. And I added that. And I asked Him to make me a great giver today. On the physical plane, yeah, but really on the spiritual plane of my time and my energy and of my attention, which that great listener thing is about that. I ask Him each morning to bless me that I quit praying for guidance over 30 years ago. I haven't done it since. One morning I was praying for guidance, and it occurred to me, one, I'm giving God His instructions. And God's hard to train. You may have noticed that. When I ask for guidance, I think I'm giving Him His instructions. The second thing is, it occurred to me that a loving God is sending His guidance every day, all day, as a free and clear gift. I'm asking Him for what's already been given. What I ask is that I would be open to His guidance today. All the blocks of channel between me and God are at my end. His end clear. And I ask very specifically for three things, that I don't miss any chances to be of service. As I read the big book, there's no theme that is more often mentioned than being of service. That I don't miss any chance to be of service or to spread love and joy, which is really the same thing as being of service, I think. I was diagnosed with cancer in my throat in June of 20, and it was going to be arduous. And it was, they took my teeth, as you may have noticed, and they hadn't been able to replace them. And they killed my jawbone. Apparently you can't have dead teeth, or you can't have teeth in a dead jawbone. And I realized very quickly in morning prayer one morning what my assignment was during this time. My assignment was to cheer up the people that were trying to cheer me up. And so what I did was I put a clown nose on my mask, and I carry them with me. I've got clown noses in my pocket all the time. I've been carrying them for a long time. Sometimes the interstate comes to stop in Nashville, and I have an attitude eclipse when that happens, and I don't want to be angry. So what I learned is if I pull out a clown nose and put it on, and then I start trying to get the other driver's attention, and the way I do that is I drop my window and I pull one of these bubble things out of my pocket, and I start blowing bubbles out the window to get the attention of the other drivers. So they see the clown nose and start laughing. Laughter is contagious, and I start laughing, and we're still stuck in traffic, but it's not as bad as it was. So I've been carrying clown noses for a long time, so it's a very natural thing for me to just go ahead and put one on my mask. Because, see, I don't need to be cheered up. I'm sitting in God's lap. My fear of death's been gone for over 30 years. I know when it left. I was sitting at my desk typing, and all of a sudden I got this twinge in my lower back. Within 10 minutes, I was in pain that I did not know was available. I didn't know you could hurt like that. I didn't know it was possible. The term is writhing in pain. I've heard it, didn't know what it meant. It means the pain is so severe that you cannot be still. That I'm having to move, knowing that moving isn't going to change it. I can't not move. And I'm in the car being driven to the hospital, and it occurs to me that I've offered God my will and my life, never had offered him my death. So I did. I said, I'm not asking to go, but if it's time and it's your will, take me. My fear of death's been gone since then. I checked the other day. I didn't mean to. I'm on a, because of this, all the radiation did, I got scar tissue in my throat. I live on chocolate and sure. I'm on a liquid diet for the rest of my life, it looks like. But don't feel sorry for me, because I don't. Because there are two ways I can look at it. I can either look at it, I'm on a liquid diet for the rest of my life, or I can look at it, I get to live the rest of my life. I've made my choice. Now, that's what you've given me. I don't get any credit for any of that. But it has changed it all for me. That my job continues to be to spread love and joy. Doesn't matter what's going on in my life. I'm not going to have a tombstone, but if I were, I would want this written on it. Serving the God of love is not a part-time job. It's not. It's just not. And I've tried to take it on full-time. And I don't bat 1,000, but gee, it's gotten so much better. It has gotten so much better, and I thank you for the help on that. I send love to all the places I'm going. I filled this room with love this morning prior to leaving my room. I also sent love to the interstate all the way home, to my home, to some other places. Looks like I might go today. I sent love to some friends of mine having a hard go right now. I got a couple of them that are pretty close to the transition, and I sent them love for a gentle passage to the other side. I've got a lot of friends that are in hospitals and are having physical trouble. I send them love. I sent love to all of my friends in Ukraine and in Russia. I've had the privilege of being over there a number of times, and I know a bunch of us over there, and I send them love one at a time. I send love to a lot of individuals, including each of the people that I sponsor. I just send love. I just believe that's what I'm supposed to do. I had the privilege of knowing a guy named Burke from High Point, North Carolina. Lee's got some of his talk. He's got one of his talks, and he usually brings it when I'm here because I bring it up. He's the most spiritual man I ever expect to know. And I asked Burke one time, I said, how do you be Burke? How do you do this? These just When he walks into the room, it's like somebody stuck the gold knob in and turned the world down about three quarters of a turn. Just the whole room goes, huh. I said, how do you do that? He said, I don't know. I said, let me ask you some questions. What's the very first thing you did this morning? He said, well, I thank God for an alarm clock so I get up on time. I said, really, what was the second thing you did? Well, I thanked him for a flush toilet. What was the third thing? Well, I thanked him for toothpaste and a toothbrush. Then I thanked him for a sharp razor and shaving cream and hot water. Then I thanked him for a nice warm shower and shampoo and soap. Then I thanked him for a fluffy towel. He went through the day giving thanks. It becomes such a habit, he didn't know he was doing it. I can't even aspire to that level. Every once in a while I'll pray that I might get to that level, but I can't get all the way out of the bathroom in the morning before this thing is rocking again. But what an astonishing thing to simply go through the day giving thanks and looking for chances to spread love and joy. And that's what he did. That was what he did. It says, when, as we go through today, we pause when agitated or doubtful. I'll steal this from Steve. He said, when we read that, we just stop at agitated because the alcoholic is rarely doubtful. We're not often right, but we're never in doubt. And the difference between a reaction and a response is a pause. And the longer the pause, the less chance that I'm going to have to make amends. That pause is God's in the pause. That's why that's such an important thing, is for me to just simply get here and stay here. But to get into that pause so that if I find myself in anger, I can pray and ask God to change it to sadness. What I've discovered is that anger and love never travel together. If I'm in one of those, I am not in the other. Sadness and love do. And if I can get changed from anger to being sad about what's going on instead of angry, then I can react, I can respond in love. And I respond in love, I don't find myself making amends. And I'm not terribly fond of making amends. So that's been an important thing for me. I don't believe in tough love. I never have seen anybody applying what they call tough love. Didn't look to me like unresolved control issues. Like they were beating somebody up with what they thought of as the truth. And I think it needs to be gentle. At least for me it does. I moved out of the home my first wife and I were living in when I was sober 6 years. And without going into all of that, one of the things that happened was I have a picture of myself taken when I was about 4 years old. This happy little boy in a straw hat and a jumper. And I had it blown up 2 feet wide, 3 feet high, put on the wall at the foot of my bed. And I'm used to living pretty good. I was in an apartment. It was not in the nicest part of town. And it was the last thing I saw at night, the first thing I saw in the morning. I had no idea why I'd done it. Don't know how long it had been there. And one time I was looking at that and it occurred to me, sometime not too long after that picture was taken, things happened to that little boy shouldn't happen to any child. And I've also done some pretty terrible things myself. But it occurred to me, who would he have become if he had received all the love and nurturing and guidance he deserved clearly as a child of God? Who would he have become? And I got my answer. The answer is my assignment to become the man he would have become. I serve a God who's bigger and stronger than all of that stuff, period. The only question is, am I willing to do the work? I think the work is the 12 steps. And this is, if you're new, we're not here to change you into anything. You're already everything you ever needed to be. You just didn't know it. Don, who Billy referred to a couple of times, was one of my great teachers also. And he said, the alcoholic is like an electromagnet that's been dragged through the junkyard of life. We got all this rusty, jagged, nasty, sharp stuff stuck all over us. And through the process of the 12 steps, we get a hold of that power control and turn that power down, and that stuff falls away. And this beautiful thing you've always really been emerges. We're not going to change you into anything. Not at all. And there was a lady in the first meeting concerned about step four. Let me tell you a secret about step four. There's no surprises. I mean, you were there. Yeah. And what he said was that all that garbage in your past is not who you are. It's who you're not. And what we will teach you here is how to quit doing who you're not, how to repair the damage for having done who you're not, and who you really are will emerge from the ashes like the phoenix. that's been my experience with it. That's what this is about. This loving, laughing God who invented, I might note, smallmouth bass, vanilla ice cream, and sex. Good job, right? That, I've seen his work. That guy was not having a bad day in the middle of a long losing streak when he created you. It didn't happen. We were just wrong about that. We don't have time to midnight tonight to talk about all the things I was wrong about. That was just one of the big ones. Just one of the big ones. So it's my job to evolve into who I've always really been. That's what this process is about. And I come out of the haze. I got sober on my 41st birthday against my will. And I come out of the haze, and I don't know much about myself. Not much at all. I know I'm a heterosexual male. I know I like to shoot pool and drive airplanes and fish. That ain't much for 41 years. And I've had to explore to find out. And I had to give myself permission to try something, and it doesn't work. You know, anything we're doing is we're doing poorly as you learn to do it. I didn't know that. I thought if I couldn't do it perfectly from the gate, I wouldn't want to do it at all. And so I had to explore, and I got a wild hair. I was sober about 10 years. I thought, boy, I want to do pottery. I want to sit at the wheel and feel the clay and do all that. And I was in that for a couple of weeks, ran into a lady in one of my meetings, had a pottery shop. I went and sat at the wheel for a day, and I don't ever want to do that. Yuck! No! But I went and found out, and I didn't have to buy a kiln and a wheel and 2,000 pounds of clay. It's really important to just kind of experiment and find out, and it doesn't work, and that's okay. So I didn't know that. I didn't know that. There were so many things I didn't know, and we don't have time to cover them all. I had the privilege some years ago, Betty Ford's son, and I can't call his name, came to Nashville and did a talk, and I had the privilege of hearing him. And he said that his mother used to tell the story that the hummingbird and the buzzard fly over the exact same field. One looking for something beautiful and one looking for something ugly. And they both find what they're looking for. I have the choice each morning to do these things you've taught me, to begin my day with an excitement about what God's got in store for me today, so that I can have a hummingbird day. Because if I don't do that, I turn back into a buzzard. I don't want to be anyone anymore. I love you with all my heart. Thank you.